Blog Talk Radio.
Doing. This is Cliff, your host, and you're probably wondering why this sounds so good. We're now in HD, so each show in the future is going to be high fidelity, high definition, and the quality of the sound is going to be great. By the way, I just played the long version of the intro just because I wanted you to hear the quality of the sound. And by the way, for those of you who don't really know the music, it's the actual title of that song is Atlantis by Olive Mystique. Musique. And that's a Euro band that did that for me about a year ago. They're in France, actually. And so I will, look forward to hearing from people telling me, hey, man, that's a great sound. And the interviews should sound better. The pre-records should sound better. So you should all be really enjoying this the sound from start to finish. Chris Dunn, my guest last week, continues to amaze me. He's the number one download. He's up to about 2,500 downloads on his program, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. And I mentioned when Chris was on the on with me that he's referred to by so many different people, TV, radio, and actually he's not given enough credit for his discoveries. I mean, he is credited not only with showing the various machine cuts in stone. He refers to Petrie, William Flanders Petrie, who in the 1800s describes a lot of these machining cuts, drilling holes, and things like that. But Petrie wasn't a technologist like Chris Dunn is. And Dunn actually takes it to the next level and reveals that there's a certain spin revolution, cut rate, drill rate in a lot of these surface stones that are left to us by the ancient Egyptians. And what was interesting about some of the things that he said, one of the most interesting things is he believes that the technology is significantly older, going into very deep into prehistory. Now, he doesn't come up with a number, and I thought that was kind of interesting, but he's more concerned over the techniques, the actual cuts, the actual finished sculptures. And even though I tried asking him a couple of different times, different ways to give us an idea for the age, he couldn't do that. He didn't feel comfortable doing that. And that's the sign of a true scientist. You know, he's not going to say something that he doesn't know as a fact or has tested to know as a fact. And so we'll just leave it at that. I'm hoping at some point the technology will be such that they can date these stones a little better so that we do know. So anyhow, Chris Dunn continues to fascinate, and it was really a pleasure to have him on the program. This week on Facebook, the Facebook Earth Ancients page, I've posted a number of quite interesting articles. Carlton Brown, who was my guest a few weeks ago, is traveling up through Guatemala into Central America, up through Mexico. And he has been continually posting and sending to me photos of some of these larger ruins. Now, Carlton wrote a book called Sun God, Sacred Secrets, where he focuses quite a bit on pyramidal structures and the ancients' ability to understand key lines and energetic focal points for building. And he has one of the most amazing series of photographs of Mitla in just south of Mexico City. And if you take a look at it, I don't have a title for it. It was posted a few days ago, November 11th. This one citadel, this one main building, is beautifully constructed. In fact, it's so well designed, it actually looks like it's something from a modern building. And if you look at the outer structure, there's a lot of unusual patterns. And one of the things he has emailed me and said that he finds quite amazing is that the various patterns look like they were machined, like they were cut with some kind of a machine. He's going to send some additional photographs, or I'm going to see if I can find some additional photographs of this. But this main palace at Mitla is fascinating, and it actually appears that there's quite a bit of concrete used on the main entranceway, the main, I guess it's the front of the palace. So take a look at that if you haven't. It's on the Facebook page. It was posted on November 11th. And of course, I'm a huge fan of ruins in Mexico. I think that's really where more research needs to be done. And of course, being an American living here in California, I have ample time to get down there. Well, I don't have ample time. I should say it's easier for me to get down there than other people that live in Europe or Asia or Australia or whatever. Anyhow, so check that out. The other area that continues to fascinate me is this this comet 67P that the European Space Agency landed a satellite on. And I just posted a series of photographs. In fact, the title of that post is Amazing New Photos from the Comet 67P. And the satellite's called Rosetta. And it's amazing that they were able to do that. I think even NASA was wondering how the hell they landed. And it's actually a small portion of the main Rosetta satellite that was landed. But the photographs that they are sending back are amazing. It's funny because a number of anomalous researchers are sending photographs that are saying, oh, there's pictures of alien buildings and there's actual people walking around the surface of this this comet, which I find fascinating. Of course, that's always going to kind of be the trip when you're dealing with out in space. People are going to go, hey, you know, there's aliens on that. So I won't be posting any of those photos because they're probably Photoshopped, but you should take a look at this this comet. It's quite fascinating. The research, the what they're going to take ground penetrating cuts into this comet to extract data on, you know, the age, maybe get an idea of an analysis of the soil and things like that. So continues to really surprise. The last thing I want to talk about real quickly, and then we're going to go to our guest today, is Robert Breval, in his book Secret Chambers Revisited, posted a number of tools that were found in the pyramid that they're never discussed in Orthodox circles because they're anomalous discoveries. And in his book, he actually shows a series of iron tools that were found in the king's chamber in the 1800s. And what I posted is a photo of some kind of a hand tool that was discovered in 1837 that appears to have been part of a larger tool that had some kind of purpose. And these kind of discoveries are never discussed in any mainstream. You know, you won't see them on Smithsonian. You won't see them on National Geographic because it just, you know, they can't explain it. And if they can't explain it, then it gets hidden, it gets put away. And this is what Earth Ancients is all about. And the subtitle of Earth Ancients is Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. And this is one of those discoveries. The title of it, which I pulled up, is Did the Pyramid Builders of Giza Have Iron Tools? And this is from his book. And quite an amazing piece of metal. It's dark, it's oxidized. It doesn't actually say where he got it. I think he found it. He's over there. He actually is in Giza quite a bit of the year doing research. So, something to check out. My guest today is Preston Peete, and Preston has written quite an interesting book that I've had a chance to look at, but it's much larger than I originally thought. I downloaded it in a digital form, and the title of the book is Disinformation Guide to Ancient Aliens, Lost Civilizations, Astounding Archaeology, and Hidden History. And it's a unique perspective from a number of different authors and investigators' perspective. And what I mean by that is that it continues what Earth Ancients is all about. It kind of focuses on what we talk about. It has people like Graham Hancock and a number of authors and investigators that we have had on the program here. John Anthony West is featured prominently. Preston is the editor of Under the Influence, The Disinformation Guide to Drugs. He's a writer, editor, photographer, musician, actor, DJ, activist, and adventurer. He's a regular contributor to High Times magazine and its website. And he is the controversial web. Oh, he was also the editor of drugwar.com and a columnist for New York Waste. And he's also published a number of articles, I guess, both online and print. But we want to get them on here and talk to them about this amazing book. Hey, Preston, how you doing today?
I'm good, Cliff. Good to be here.
Cool. Hey, this is a monstrous book. What was your motivation for pulling this together? I'm very curious about that.
Well, I've long had a love of lost civilizations, the whole idea that there were people here as far back as history goes, and then as far back again, at least, you know, into the mists of time. I've just loved that idea ever since I was going to church as a little kid. My whole upbringing was talking about these people before the flood. Who were these people? I was so curious. I wanted to know. And my parents took me out to New Mexico as a child, and we lived a summer on the Navajo Reservation, and I got to see Mesa Verde, the cliff dwellings, and various other assorted ruins all over the Four Corners region, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado. Just, there's so much to see there that it really just grabbed me. So, I don't know, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I had begun writing for Disinformation pretty steadily, and they asked me to do Under the Influence, and I did Under the Influence. And when I finished that, I was looking around for something else that I wanted to cover, that I felt I had something to say and to bring to the public. And I realized that I could turn this love of archaeology and ancient mysteries into another book project, and pitched the idea. And the Disinformation Company publisher told me, yes, we'll give you the contract if your first wish list contributor, which was Graham Hancock, will agree to a contract. Agree to contribute, we'll give you your contract. And I said, okay. And I wrote Graham, and Graham responded within just a couple hours and said, yes, it sounds fantastic. I'd be happy to contribute. I love the idea. I love the look of Under the Influence. I'd be glad to participate. And when I approached Disinformation again the following Monday, they said, oh, that's fantastic. Now you've got to tell him what he's going to be paid. And if he still agrees.
Oh, boy.
And he was very gracious, and he said, yes, I'll even contribute 2 articles for you. And so he did. And now I'm fairly good friends with Graham. He's good people. He was actually the other presenter besides myself at the book release party here in New York City at Alex Gray's Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, when Chapel of Sacred Mirrors was still here in Manhattan. Well, it was still in Manhattan. I'm in Brooklyn now. But it was still in Manhattan, in Midtown Manhattan, and it was fantastic. It was a standing room only crowd, and Graham did a whole presentation. I believe it was based on his Supernatural book when he was touring for that. He gave that presentation to the assembled mass of people. It was good fun.
How fortunate that he was in town to be able to talk.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was perfect. It was perfect timing. Absolutely.
Excellent. Tell me the title. Was it your intention to use the term disinformation? Because basically, it's almost fitting, because what you're saying here is a book I have assembled on what I believe is the truth of our history, right. And what we've been fed is not the truth.
Disinformation, right. It's disinformation or misinformation, yes.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Disinformation comes from the publishing company. It's the Disinformation Company. And when they were originally founded, I believe in 96, I think was when they first hit the internet, they came out specifically with the credo, there's not 2 sides to any story. There are at least 50 sides to any story. And we want to be able to make them all available to the public at large, who can then make their own mind what they find most credible. And I fit right into that. I love that idea, and I love promoting that idea. I think it's fantastic. I don't personally even believe everything that I published in this book to be the truth, but I think it's well-argued and informative, and it's not up to me to decree what is and isn't 100% the truth. It is up to me to make available as wide an assortment of viewpoints as possible that don't get attention. It was interesting when I was pitching to contributors, trying to get the people together, I went for a lot of my favorite writers and researchers and investigators, and also I targeted a lot of academics and mainstream archaeologists, and
right.
I got almost no feedback from academics at all. They just treated it like it was below them, not even worth responding to. It was really frustrating. I was very disappointed. Not that I find anyone more credible. Well, no, that's not true. I do find some people less credible and more credible. I wouldn't be so there.
Well, let me ask you this. It's a large volume. Is there a focus? Because you have quite a few people, a number of authors in there that I really admire. Some of them I've never heard about. We'll talk about a little bit later, talk about a few. Yeah. But was there a certain pattern that you pulled together that is a focal point, or did you just decide to touch on a number of different areas? Because you go from Van Doneghan to Graham Hancock to John Anthony West and back. Is there a certain theme that you are trying to dispel here?
The main focus on my part was to just mainly present alternative viewpoints to what I considered the mainstream, because that's easy to find. My girlfriend at the time, her mother, who was basically my mother-in-law at that point, it was that kind of relationship, she gave me a book. She knew I was doing this project, and she gave me a book for Christmas that year. It was the 100 greatest archaeological discoveries, like of all time. And it was a beautiful book. It is a beautiful book. I love it. It looks great in my library, and it was a lot of fun to look through. But it's very mainstream. There's no even nod to the idea that perhaps there's alternatives to the Bering land bridge theory, may be people here prior to Clovis, possibly. Mm-hmm. Topper's not mentioned, things like that. It's like I was very disappointed. I wanted to give these people a voice.
Cool.
And was happy to have a publisher that agreed with me.
Do you believe there's a conspiracy about actually telling the truth of man's history?
To be honest, I think any conspiracy about telling the truth about man's history is more in the individual, how would I put this? It happens more on an individual case-by-case basis. Take Zahi Hawass, for instance, in Egypt. I don't think he's necessarily working for the anti-Illuminati or the evil Masons to keep wider knowledge hidden. But at the same time, he quite possibly for personal gain, allowing certain people to profit off of archaeological discoveries or finds or treasures or what have you, he may have cut off research to other researchers, not allowed certain researchers to investigate on the Giza Plateau, looking for the chamber under the Sphinx, say, or to send Upawat back up the star shaft again, that kind of thing. He definitely kept people from doing it. So in that sense, there was a conspiracy. But did he do it for a larger nefarious purpose than simply? I'm not sure how far to take that kind of thing. I don't think there's an evil cabal somewhere hidden in a smoky room saying we're not going to allow humanity at large to know that our origins are from, cone-headed alien hybrids. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's happening. But, look what happened to Virginia McIntyre? Is that her last name? The woman in Mexico. She found dates that were much too old to be accepted by the status quo, and they shut her down.
That's a great example.
She didn't get work again. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it does happen to people, but I don't necessarily think it's a great evil, you know, underground base derived kind of conspiracy. If that's
okay. Well, I asked that because you have a good section on Michael Cremo, who we've had on the program.
Mm, right.
And Cremo uses the term knowledge filtration.
Knowledge filtration to describe
these amazing finds that are just not revealed in examples like Smithsonian Institute.
Right. Absolutely. That's true.
What do you say about on that knowledge filtration? Because you do.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
When you put it like that, then yeah, I would say that in a sense, yeah, there is kind of a larger conspiracy in a manner of speaking. But I still don't necessarily think that guys are getting together, or guys and women. But we can come back to that and women if you want later. I was noticing something in my table of contents. I don't think that there's a group of people, professionals, that are meeting to decree what is and what isn't acceptable, but I think it is kind of maybe unspoken, accepted. They know to get to the position where they are at the heads of the Smithsonian, the heads of, you know, the Metropolitan Museum, you know, or the Museum of Natural Science here in New York, whatever. To get to those positions, they have to know when to say yes and when to say no. Do you know what I mean? To fit in, to get that promotion, they have to know what paper to give the nod to and what paper to say, we're not publishing that. We're not giving that the thumbs up or the thumbs down. So that could be a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get your stuff featured or published if it doesn't fit into a certain paradigm.
Exactly. You know? And that's what
and
Cremo
so that
talks
is a conspiracy.
About, yeah.
That is a conspiracy, but it's sort of like it just is. That sounds kind of like a cop-out, maybe, but it's something that we could change. Just because it is doesn't mean it has to be. You know, if enough people make enough noise, I think maybe it's possible that we could start to see Graham Hancock and Robert Duvall and John Anthony West and Christopher Dunn, people like that, actually being paid attention to by the mainstream, getting featured at the Smithsonian or Natural Science Museum.
What
have you, you know?
Yeah.
You know, considering the things that Graham came out with in his Fingerprints of the Gods, talking about the, you know, this forgotten civilization that may have preceded us, and the finds at Göbekli Tepe that came out afterwards, you know, the people were damn sure, if I'm allowed to say that, they
of
were
course.
100% sure that there was no connection between old and new world pyramids, because there are no new world pyramids as old as the new world pyramids. And then Corral is stumbled upon, and we know for a fact Corral was thriving at the same time that Giza was being, well, the Giza is asserted to be assembled by the mainstream. There's plenty of researchers. I take that back. Alleged to have been built, you know, because it could be a lot older, as some researchers are sure of. But that doesn't mean that the ones at Corral aren't much older also. You know what I mean? I think that the possibility of connections between the old and new world are completely feasible. You know?
Well, so, let's talk about the book here. And this is an amazing book. Part of the title is Ancient Aliens, and of course, that always brings up Eric Von Däniken. Mm-hmm. And you have a section in the book. Can you give us an example of where he proves that the Earth has been visited by people outside of the Earth? Because I have studied Native mythology and actually spoken and worked with a number of elders, and there is a period and there's a direct tradition of working with star people, and those are aliens. But that's old. I'm just curious as to what you found compelling about Van Daniken? Can you give us an example?
Compelling about Van Daniken.
Well, I mean, in his discoveries, I mean, he basically says the, you know, I mean, you didn't talk about this, but I'm just curious. He refers to the Nazca lines as being
runways,
and but the thing is, his book, all his books are like, okay, it's all aliens. It's all aliens.
Right. It's everything is aliens. Everything. Character, and now I don't personally think that aliens are the ones that we can put all our credit to. I don't think that aliens are the ones that gave us fire. You know, if you know what I mean. I think it's 100% possible that aliens could have come here and contributed to our upbringing, to our DNA, to education, to our arms races, to our ideas of kingship, whatever. But I don't think that that is what happened. It's just a possibility, like any other possibility. With Eric Van Daniken, I think it's great that he came out at the right time in the right place in history to make it a widely noticed topic to discuss, because it opened up people's minds to the idea that there are mysteries in our past. Taking myself for a great example, there was a time in my youth where I was much more gung-ho about the idea that ancient aliens were the ones, you know. I loved the idea. I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and they're bringing all the kidnapped people back. I loved this idea that there were ancient aliens, because this is all at the same time that I was introduced to all this stuff. But I, as I got older, I became more widely read, and there are many more options available, which is why I present such a wide array of contributors in this collection, because it's not just ancient aliens. They could just have been one of any number of things that really did happen. They don't have to be exclusive of one another either, these different theories.
But that show is so popular. Ancient Aliens is seen by millions of people.
Right.
And I know Van Daniken, he spawned all that.
Absolutely.
So you're saying he's
the one that really made it popular.
Yeah, but would you say that he should be remembered for? I think you're right in many ways. He should be remembered for actually making people think about other options for history. So
whether that was his intention or not, that's what he did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't think he necessarily set out to make people think about the wide array of other possibilities. I think he wants them focused on his possibility, but he did. That's definitely what he has done. Because there were a few other people before him. Gosh, and of course I say that, and I can't remember off the top of my head any examples, but there were a number of people prior to him that mentioned the idea of aliens contact. I was just reading somebody the other day, mention of some name.
Yeah, Robert Giroux, Lost Civilization. There's one book that Van Daniken focused on. It was called, and I read it as a kid, it was called 100,000 Years of Man's Unknown History by a French guy named Robert Giroux.
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds like what I'm thinking of.
And that book blew me away, and I had that. That's like 1976.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, right on.
But anyhow, hey, let's go to this chapter that I thought was quite interesting. It's called, the chapter you wrote is called Did the Inca Build Machu Picchu? And it's based on some of the work of David Hatcher Childress. And
right.
Tell us about that, about what you write in there. That chapter speculates on the builders.
That's him. He wrote that. David Hatcher Childress wrote that.
Did he write that contribution?
Absolutely. He wrote that contribution.
Okay.
That's his chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that speculates on some of the tremendous masonry work that's done, not only in Machu Picchu, but in Cusco and Sacsayhuaman.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that. That's interesting.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite focal points is the masonry of all these sites, this huge masonry. not just, scores of pounds, but multiple tons, scores of tons, hundreds of tons in many cases, where these people are alleged by the mainstream to buy manpower, ropes, rollers, tree trunks, wet sand is a current favorite I've seen focused on Egypt now, where they pour water in very minute amounts into the sand preceding the sleds that are on which they have the huge statues or masonry blocks. And it wets the sand just enough to allow the sled to glide over the sand, but not so much that it sinks down into it and grabs it, which sounds feasible, but gosh, I hate to cite Ancient Aliens, but they did a great job, I thought, on showing how remarkable the moving of some of this masonry is, in that modern movers and quarrymen that take these huge chunks, say they want to move a 1,000-ton block of stone. Yeah. They have to redesign the roadway. It's not just a simple matter of getting enough men around that stone and pulling it to its point of its destination and lifting it onto its companion stone. It's also getting it there up the incline. These places in South America, they were mining it across the valley, dropping it, 1,000 feet or more down to the valley floor. And by dropping it, I don't mean literally dropping it, because it would break. They had to manhandle that sucker down the mountain, across the valley, often across the river at the bottom of the valley, and then up the other side to the top of, where Machu Picchu is. He points out lazy stones, I think they're called, that were left along the roadway on the way to their destination, that the builders of the construction didn't get some of those stones even all the way up. They just leave them lying alongside the roadway. It just goes to show I don't know if it's in that article. Let me see if I can find it. There's another article in here with a lot of photographs of the stonework.
You do talk about that, which is interesting, that in some cases they just left the stone along a road because they couldn't pull it any further, or they got tired of dealing with it, or somebody said, "Hey, screw it, we're going."
Richard Nisbet's article, "Ancient Walls," has a lot of photographs of some of the masonry and the quarry, where they actually took these stones. There's a, mm-hmm. there's a photo of this wheel that's with an axle hole in the center of it. Like, what were they using this round circular wheel stone for? What was the purpose of that?
I saw that picture of that. He's standing over that wheel. Did they, was it attached to something? I can't tell.
It doesn't say. It does not say. It just says that he's there with the anomalous wheel. He doesn't really get into any more detail than that. But it was found amongst all this other discarded material along the construction route, whatever place they're investigating right there. I think it's the Sacsayhuaman.
Yeah.
It's just amazing, the size of these stones. How do they fit enough people in close enough vicinity to move this stone, whichever one it is? I mean, even 500 tons.
Yeah.
One ton. I mean, that's just so heavy. I'm not saying it's aliens at all. I just personally want to know what kind of technology ancient humans have. Because you take even Göbekli Tepe. Those people are so ancient, and they're lifting, most of those T-stones, the large monoliths that are at Göbekli Tepe that have so far been uncovered, they're in the multiple ton range, and these are people that haven't, started pottery yet. That doesn't sound right. That sounds really weird to me, and I just don't understand how that could possibly be.
Yeah, it's like there was a technology in place, 10, 12, 15,000 years ago that was lost.
No, absolutely.
There's something missing. There's something lost.
Absolutely.
It's curious because you're talking about Peru, and one of my big things there is the strange softening looking stones at Sacsayhuama and also in the town of Cusco.
Right,
and you have a little article, you talk about some work by Brian Fawcett, who is the son of Colonel Perry Fawcett, and his description of rock molding liquid. Can you talk a little bit about that? This liquid that is found, that I guess Fawcett found by accident, that actually...
Yeah, but there's not been much more information other than that, as far as I know.
Oh, that's it, huh? Okay.
That's really about it. Yeah, it's more one of these like assertions, but didn't really seem to go anywhere. And nobody has like a little vial of this magical stone softening liquid. You know, what do we keep it in if it softens the stone? You know, it makes me kind of wonder. You know, was he telling us a fish story? Because it sounds great. Because you're right, there's a lot of that stonework that definitely looks like it's been molded or poured.
Yeah.
You know, I really wonder, because some of the stones are so incredibly gargantuan. And they have that look, that perfectly rounded. How do you pick up these, you know, say it's a, you know, 10, 20, 50 ton stone, and keep picking it up and putting it down when it has multiple angled sides, and you're fitting it precisely in with all of its surrounding masonry? How do you keep picking it up and grinding it just so to make sure it's, okay, that's fit enough, this side's fit enough, because those edges go all the way through. They're not just on the faces. Those fine razor sharp edges that we see, those are all the way along the stone on all its faces. That to the micron, you know, micron level of magnification. It's just, you know, when you see Christopher Dunn use his engineering tools to show you the light not coming through the back of the tool, between the tool and the stone, and you see how fine that work is. How do they do that with those multiple ton stones? Unless they were softening in it somehow. And I don't necessarily know if that's true or not, but it's amazing to think about, because it does look like melted rock.
Well, there's a number of investigators who, one of them is a Dutch engineer, a guy named Jan Peter de Jong, who believes that high heat was used at Cusco and Sacsayhuama building masonry to either melt the rock to form it, and then the results of using the high heat is this vitrification, this skin, this high reflective skin. So that's one theory. And then the other theory is that the ancients discovered or used some form of science, and the liquid was created that actually melts rock. So when I read this passage in your book by Brian Fawcett, I thought that was quite amazing.
It would be really cool if we had an example of this liquid, you know, to show ourselves today. It would be even more impressive, I think.
You know? Well, so
there's examples of those vitrified forts all over the world, vitrified masonry. You know, it's not just in South America. Scotland has a huge assortment of forts, what we call forts, with vitrified stonework. You know, I wonder about, you know, its connection to some sort of calamity, considering the size of the stonework that's being used, and the idea that it would take a lot of energy to melt the stone. Because again, I'm citing an Ancient Aliens show. Gosh, I can't believe I'm doing this.
Okay.
They show in the same episode where they're talking about redesigning the rover. Yeah, where they're talking about redesigning the rover to be able to move these huge stones. They show an example of this mason heating the stone to try to spalt off pieces of it or to mold the stone. And the stone doesn't just melt and turn liquid. It doesn't liquid. You know, you don't see liquefaction on the rock. It just heats up. It's kind of like heating up. It doesn't really do much. It doesn't turn into lava. So I don't know how you would heat up a stone, because he's applying direct heat, like from a blowtorch on the stone, and it's not doing anything but getting hot. And eventually he can crack it, but it doesn't get soft under this direct heat. I don't know how hot he gets it, but he gets it up, you know, over 1,000 degrees, as far as I know. That's what saying. I believe that's what he's saying. Yeah, it looks hot to me, and it doesn't melt. So the idea that you're going to direct heat in that fine of a direction, you know, in that controlled of a manner on a construction project boggles my mind. But then again, I don't know how they're even carrying the stone to begin with. So, you know, that's just one more mystery on top of another mystery, if they were doing that or not, you know. You know, and that's why I love this subject, because it's every day we have new discoveries that change what my own theory and my own idea of what our past was like, and change the mainstream even. The mainstream paradigm changes all the time. Göbekli Tepe's, you know, had a huge impact on the way mainstream archaeology thinks today. You know, I saw you post something from the Topper site the other day on your ancient Earth Ancients website about radiocarbon dates. So it was found back in 2004. That should have made people start thinking a little more broadly, but that hasn't seemed to gain as much attention as the Göbekli finds, unfortunately. Because I mentioned that, actually, the Topper site. I thought it was interesting that you posted this article, because I mentioned the Topper site in the introduction to this book, This Information Guide to Ancient Aliens. You know, I mentioned Topper and how it is a paradigm changer.
Yeah.
Or it should be. And you know, because it was just being discovered, you know.
Yeah, 2004 that was discovered. It's funny, though, that it takes so long for mainstream historians to change the books. I mean, the Clovis theory is still big about America.
Right.
And yet there's discoveries that predate Clovis by thousands and thousands of years.
Absolutely.
So it's weird. It's totally weird. Let me talk some more about this great book of yours. You have a section in your book on Charles Hapgood.
Right.
And one of the things that I didn't know that he talked about is he believed that there was a science that's over 100,000 years old. Mm-hmm. Can you describe, because I mean, he touches on it, but I didn't get a chance to read what examples of this 100,000-year-old science he refers to. Who wrote about that in the book? Was it, because Charles Hapgood has been dead now for...
What's the title of the chapter? I can tell you, because I'm like skimming through it and I'm not seeing it.
It was a section where, of course, he wrote the Sea God Map book.
Right, Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings.
After the Sea Kings, but I don't know. I just pulled it from there because I was fascinated by his belief that there were sciences. That existed over 100,000 years ago, and I thought, whoa! And I think it might have been a reference to the fact that in one of the maps that he analyzes, he shows the perimeter of not only the North America, but he shows the perimeter of Greenland before ice was on it. And maybe it was maybe it was the fact that. There must have been a science to be able
to. That's such a huge area of study now. These ancient maps and portolans you know, it's Greenland and it's Antarctica and it's South America and various mysterious islands which have disappeared and are no longer where these maps repeatedly say they are. Which isn't, you know, islands disappear and, you know, rise and vanish all the time, but continent coastlines mapped under the ice and have it turn out to be pretty spot on is fairly mind-boggling. That's very definitely an ancient science. I thought that was pretty much Hapgood's focus, was the map reading, personally. That was his example of 100,000-year old science.
That was a big one, but I think the biggest... the problem with a lot of his theory is he has the crust displacement, Earth crust displacement. Yeah, and the guy died before he could really get into it too much. But one of his biggest fans was Albert Einstein, who actually believed that this crust displacement was a big possibility. But the thing is, there's a lot of geologists that believe that that can't happen, that you just can't have huge sections.
The crust can slip in its entirety. I'm not sure if I think the entire crust can slip, but it seems pretty evident to me that there has been some sort of displacement, whether it's the actual poles themselves physically, the entire globe shifting, or if it's only magnetic poles that are shifting, and somehow that has enough effect on how the climate changes, because the ice sheets seem to have spread over the north and southern hemispheres from directions that would make the poles, the north and south pole, like the center point for the spread, to be in different locations, like in northern Canada as opposed to the North Pole where it is today. It would be much further south in the northern hemisphere, you know, the North Pole, like around the Hudson Bay area,
right?
You know, as some researchers think. And I don't know if that's because the crust slipped and made it thus, or changed it from that, or if it's because, like I said, it's magnetic shifting, or if it's just a piece of the planet. And if the pole did shift, why are some of the measurements in some of these ancient monuments not, why are they still aligned? You know, how some of these ancient monuments are supposed to be dedicated to calamities, or have been built prior to calamities that wiped out the civilizations that built them. But they didn't change the setting of these intricate machines that are supposedly left behind. I'm kind of curious as to how this is.
Yeah, possible.
How this is possible? How these various researchers can balance those two? You know, because I definitely see. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Hapgood's a fascinating guy. He really is.
Right.
I mean,
I wish you could tell me what chapter you were focusing on, because I could.
You know, I just grabbed that thought because I saw his name. Let's move on to ancient America. And this, you
Absolutely.
Have a number of descriptions of discoveries of ancient Roman coins that are found in parts of America. And
right.
somebody who I really appreciate is a guy named Dr. Barry Fell.
Yeah, absolutely. Does all the language.
Can you talk a little bit about what he's working on?
Well, his stuff with Ogham, is that how you say it?
I think so.
Celtic
yeah.
writing? I think that's how you say it. He's found numerous examples of that all over North America. And granted, I don't see very many people substantiating what he's saying, but I don't see a lot of people even taking a look at what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more... It's so incredible that nobody's going to give it. It's that he's running into the silent, or he was running into the silent conspiracy we were discussing earlier. It's that knowledge filtration. They don't want to look at it because it's just not possible. But he has found plenty of examples of things written down on stone, you know, in the Midwest, in Oklahoma. I was watching something not very long ago. I wasn't watching. It was something online about a cave that was showing solar alignments, and Barry Fell had come out to do an interpretation of some scratches that turned out, according to him, to be... God, I keep saying Ogham, and I don't think that's the right word.
So you're talking about Norsemen, or not Celtic. Is it Celtic language?
I think, yeah, it's an Irish. It's just simple lines. Lines up and down lines. It's not cuneiform.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Celtic that he was talking about.
Yeah.
I think that's what he was saying. Yeah.
But identifies quite a few places in America that show that there were you know direct shipping lines or shipping lanes from Europe to the America to North America. In you know thousands of years ago, before the people who we say were there, you know, I mean, it really changes the perspective of ancient America, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely! A great chapter on that is the one by George Erickson and Ivar Zapp, titled "Atlantis in America: Summing Up." I really like those two. Their book, "Atlantis in America," was fantastic. One of my favorite topics in the Lost Civilizations area is the idea of transoceanic contacts between old and new worlds. Constance Irwin, back in the, I believe she published her book, is either the late 50s or the 60s, Fair Gods and Stone Faces. That was just fantastic. It's full of photographs and illustrations of various, you know, bearded faces found all over North, South and Central America that are 100% pre-Columbian. There's no possibility that they were post-Columbian. And she collected many, you know, of these illustrations and photographs and stories about prisoners and strange people with fair skin and bearded faces that had been kept as slaves by this or that tribe or royal household or what have you. So this chapter, Atlantis in America, discusses a lot these shipping lanes. The fact that the conquistadors, when they were going down to Peru, ran into what it was basically a ship for all intents and purposes, you know, one of these balsa wood raft type constructions that they have the centerboards that they're using as keels. I mean, these were seamen. They, you know, I have no doubt that these people were going back and forth from the Pacific Islands, say, that there was, you know, trade contact going on all over the Pacific Ocean. You know, I think there was very definitely a civilization spread out across the Pacific. You know, you look at Nan Madol. There's a chapter in the book about Nan Madol, as a matter of fact, comes to think of it, as a prime example of some of the leftover mysterious construction left from this ancient civilization that's now vanished. Gunung Padang, is that how you say it? Gunung Padang? That place is just so fascinating to me. I'm so taken with the idea that could possibly be as old as it is.
We talked about that last week, and they just found what the lead investigator calls a metal capacitor, which blows me away. Yeah. And I'm waiting. I've been trying to find a photograph of this capacitor because basically he describes it as something that would run electricity. Electricity could run through it. Yeah, I posted on Facebook a number of.
I saw you posted something. Just today or last night, I saw that you posted something about a particular stone that's made up of a different material than the.
It's metal. The stone it's an actual piece of metal. It shows that they combined metals.
I didn't see that.
They merged metals. Yeah, it's one of the early discoveries. That place is going to blow things away. Graham Hancock's been there.
I think so. And
I mean, they conservatively dated the fifth level at 20,000 BC.
So there's another prime example of the idea. And then there was, this is going to be embarrassing. Eden the East, who wrote that? Stephen something. I can't remember his last name off the top of my head. Professor Stephen something. But the book Eden in the East came out, I believe, at the end of the 90s. And he postulated the idea that mankind quite possibly spread from the East as opposed to strictly from Africa, or at least civilization did, you know, if not humanity itself, that the birthplace, Eden, was in the East, the Far East, that all those land masses were submerged. And Graham gets into it too in his book Underworld. He really, really goes into great detail about the amount of land that was lost under the ocean at the end of the last ice age. Hundreds of thousands of square miles of land just gone, vanished.
Yeah.
Poof. And we are not investigating it except barely scratching, like in the North Sea, say. But in the Pacific, there's almost no investigation at all, other than, say, at Yonaguni. And how much is a genuine investigation is going on there as opposed to sightseeing, you know? Yeah. I don't think there's, you know, there's a little bit in India, maybe.
We're having a little technical difficulty here, breaking up a little bit.
I hear that.
There you go. I think we're good. I want to move on because we're almost at our end of our hour. You have a big section in your book. Well, not a big section, but you describe you call it the Constantine Conspiracy and the Cross. Can you tell us a little bit about the Constantine Conspiracy, as you call it? I find it fascinating.
Yeah, that's the chapter. Again, these are chapters by the contributors. I'm the editor of this book. I gathered all of the contributors together. I wrote the foreword. I contributed one of the chapters to the book. I made sure everybody's work got turned in time, was succinctly put together and precise, you know. And so this is Clayton Miller's contribution. And he's also saying that there were ancient mariners traveling around the world, and what they were using was this cross shape to navigate. They didn't need the longitude, which is what we had trouble finding for so many years in the West. You know, the European nations had this competition to build a worthy sea clock to enable them to find longitude. These ancient people were using this Celtic cross design with the, it sounds very simple and it looks very simple. So it makes perfect sense to me that by using this contraption, this simple tool, they were able to measure distances by holding it up to the sky and using the angles of the sun or the constellations on the horizon, very much like a sextant, but a little more complex. It's really, really fascinating. And then they left little hints and clues of it all over the place. You know, certain secretive Masons were passing on this knowledge to other initiated, knowledgeable types, you know, that were allowed to have the information, kind of, if you know what I mean. You know, so he describes how this secret knowledge is passed down from one group to the next after it was done away with or subverted, censored, if you will. You know, the sect that had.
So people who don't know who Constantine was, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Hello?
Okay. Yep, I can hear you.
So Constantine was a Roman emperor, remember? And he basically rewrote history. And so basically the cross was a much older symbol. And then he banished that sacred information from the general public and took it out of the Bible or whatever.
Right.
And that's the conspiracy, right?
Right. He took an ancient pagan design and chased all of these old religions away and moved them all, you know, out of the limelight and replaced them with Christianity, but still used a lot of their symbology, you know, their symbolism in his Christian religion, his form of the Christian religion, you know, replacing the fish with this Celtic cross, you know, which was the original symbol of Gaul and the Western Atlantic seafaring people, you know, from Brittany or Cornwall in Scotland, Ireland, Wales. Those are the people that he was taking this symbolism from and using it as his own. According to Clayton, of course. This is Clayton's theory. You know.
Right. It's fascinating. And we know that the Bible and the whole teachings have been changed and modified over thousands and thousands. That's the biggest problem I have with the Bible is it's been modified so many times. It's like you're reading somebody's story.
You're just reading the regurgitated version, right? But he's saying that the Celtic cross was not a religious symbol to begin with. It never was and never should be a religious icon. You know, that's just a subversion of what it actually was to begin with. That it was more a symbol of power and a tool for navigation. Because if you could navigate, you had the power. It's really fascinating. It's really an interesting idea. You know, it's according to him. According to him, it's older than the pyramids. You know, it was used to construct the henges in Europe. You know, and those are older than the pyramids. So it's very interesting.
Oh, the cross was used. The hedges. Interesting. The last thing I want to talk about real quickly, because we're getting close to the hours. You have a chapter that is fascinating. It's called Modern Explorations, Anomalies, and Cover-Ups. And it's written by a guy named Greg. I'm going to try to say his last name. Greg Dermijian.
Yeah, Greg Dermijian.
Yeah. And tell us about what he discovered in Peru. He has petroglyphs I've never seen before. And this is somebody who has discovered an ancient part of South America that I've never read.
Yeah, he's really fascinating. He's really interesting. That's my contribution to the book, actually, was my interview with Gregory. He's been taking expeditions in on a pretty much annual basis for a couple of decades at least now.
Wow.
And each time he goes a little further and a little further along these ancient Incan roadways. Sacab, is that how you say them? Sacab?
Sacab,
is that right? Is that how you pronounce it? Yeah.
The Maya White Roads.
Yes, the Mayan, yes, exactly. They just spread for thousands of miles, as far as I know, right? I mean, they just go everywhere. Well, he's been following various examples of these roads further and further back to the point where he can't even start where he left off without getting a helicopter to take him to the finishing point of his previous expeditions. I mean, it's just fascinating. So he's looking specifically for this lost city of Paititi. And it's like... Machu Picchu was actually suspected to be Paititi at one point, but they decided it wasn't. It's this legendary, mythical, lost city. And he has yet to find it, but he's dogged in determination to do just that. And I'm kind of envious of him. I wish I had the stamina and the help to slog it out with him. Because it just seems fascinating to me, you know, climbing mountainsides and dashing through the brush looking for these ancient cities.
Is there something significant in what he discovered, though? Because you have one photograph in particular that are huge petroglyphs, carvings into the
stone. Those are petroglyphs at Pesharo. It's just one of numerous examples of things that he stumbled across and discovered in his travels. And I'm not sure exactly what their significance turned out to be, you know, other than the fact that it's just one example of unknown previously petroglyph work, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, hey, it's an interesting book. The book's Disinformation Guide to Ancient Aliens, Lost Civilizations, Astonishing Archaeology, and Hidden History. And my guest today has been Preston Pete. Preston, what's on the horizon for you? Are you doing another disinformation book? Or
I'm not doing another disinformation book at this point, but I'm definitely in the very beginning phases of working on a new project, again, focused on ancient mysteries. So we'll see how that goes. It's in the very, very beginning phases at this point, so I can't give you much more information than that now, but I want everybody to be eagerly anticipating it when it finally is released.
Okay. And where can we find you? Of course, you're on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook. My website, drugwar.com, is no longer active, unfortunately. But as you said, I'm easily found on Facebook. I also have a blog site on WordPress, and I do a lot of hard news, investigative writing, focused on the war on drugs, mainly for a website called Celeb Stoner, like Celebrity Stoner, but it's celebstoner.com. So it's a different field than what we've been discussing today, but that's one place where they can find me.
Cool. Very cool. Hey, it's been a pleasure. It's been a real pleasure. And I really suggest people can get the book on Amazon. You can download it as a digital book, an ebook. You can also get it hard copy. And I guess they can find it. It's distributed by the main publishing bodies of the world. So it's probably,
absolutely.
I found it fairly easily. So I really suggest it as a good overview in the field. And Hey, man, I appreciate you being on the program. Much success
to you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me and for your kind words. All right.
Okay, great.
Peace and love.
All right. My guest coming up next week is Laird Scanton, who I've had on before. He talked about the ancient symbology of China. But this new book, Velikovsky's Heresies, is a fascinating study behind a genius who had theories at the 1960s, late 50s, 1960s, that are coming true today, kind of like a scientific version in some respects of a Zachariah Sitchin. But I think you'll find what Scanton's discovered quite fascinating. As always, I recommend everyone take a look at the Facebook page. Each day I post something new, something unique. And I'm hoping to have my first book published shortly as an ebook, which is on the Black Knight satellite. And what I've discovered, I think, will fascinate you. I hope you have a great week, and thanks for joining me. We'll talk to you next week.